Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Creator of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Coming up, an inspector general says the defense secretary violated military regulations when he used a personal phone to share secret war plans. Plus, President Trump continues his barrage of insults against Somali migrants.
The words that are coming from our president are really dangerous and have real consequences.
Also, a Russia scholar says the war in Ukraine could go on a long time.
There's just no sign that Vladimir Putin wants to give up anything short of pretty serious demands.
And these are the closing days of the third era and the final hours of my life.
Our favorite video games of the year coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump continues to downplay concerns about a second strike on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean that killed two survivors. NPR's Frank Ordonez reports the administration's actions underscore they're aware of the potential fallout and are working to contain it.
President Trump insists that he didn't know about the survivors, and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth cites the fog of war in defending the follow-up strike. Presidential historian Tevi Troy says the White House is clearly trying to distance itself from responsibility for killing the survivors. He points to the briefing where the press secretary read a statement naming Admiral Bradley as the one who ordered the strike.
When a press secretary who usually speaks off the cuff reads a very carefully written statement, it usually suggests that the lawyers were involved.
Troy says there are clear legal questions, and the lawyers are trying to make sure they walk a careful line to protect the president and the presidency. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
President Trump is overseeing a peace deal signing ceremony with the presidents of the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Republic of Rwanda.
The compact we're signing today, which will be known as the Washington Accords, everybody sort of liked that name, formalizes the terms agreed to in June, including a permanent ceasefire, the disarmament of non-state forces, provisions for refugees to return to their homes, and justice and accountability for those who have committed illegal atrocities.
President Trump has said he is a ceasefire dealmaker who should receive the Nobel Peace Prize. He's touted success with the truce between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, but a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine continues to elude the president. Ukrainian and U.S. negotiators meet in Florida today following Special Envoy Steve Witkoff's talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin and his team of negotiators in Moscow this week. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports no real progress was made, though both sides say the talks were productive.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed that his negotiators would head to Florida after briefing the Europeans on the U.S.-Russian talks. Russia continues to press on the battlefield in an effort to improve its position at the negotiating table. The Kremlin claims to have taken the eastern city of Pokrovsk after a year and a half of brutal fighting and heavy losses. Ukraine denies the claim. In a statement on X, Zelensky said there is now a real opportunity to end the war. But as Kyiv and cities across Ukraine continue to come under near nightly attack, Zelensky said negotiations must be accompanied by pressure on Russia. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has also been part of the talks. The Dow is down 71 points at last check at 47,811. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. California has launched a new online tool to track unlawful conduct by federal agents using civilian reports. State Attorney General Rob Bonta says the portal is a necessary response to reports of unmarked vehicles and abduction-style arrests.
When Californians witness conduct that looks unlawful, excessive force, unnecessary detentions, unconstitutional searches, they deserve a place to report it, a place where their information is taken seriously. This portal helps us do just that.
Residents can upload photos, videos, and other information. The Attorney General's office says it can't provide legal advice to those who submit complaints, but will use the data to track patterns and for potential legal action. The U.S. Geological Survey says an alert that went off on phones across the Bay Area this morning about an earthquake was a mistake, and the agency is looking into what went wrong. Phones across the region shrilled an early earthquake notice from the MyShake app warning incorrectly of imminent shaking and people to stop, cover, and hold just after 8 a.m. The alert was wrong. It indicated that a 5.9 magnitude earthquake struck near Carson City, Nevada. The USGS quickly canceled that alert and posted a statement online that said there was no quake. They do not yet know why the warning was issued, but are looking into it. Sports, the Sharks lost to the Capitals 7-1. The Warriors play the Sixers in Philly, 4 o'clock our time. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, used by 40 million developers to build APIs that help make AI smarter decisions. More at postman.com. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And the listeners of KQED. No major changes in the weather the next several days. Weather Service says a few showers over the coastal waters expected through the next 7 days. Otherwise, a slight warming trend starts tomorrow through the weekend. No rain in the forecast.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. It is highly unusual to hear a Republican member of the Armed Services Committee publicly criticize a GOP defense secretary. Today, Ohio Congressman Mike Turner was asked on MS Now if he had confidence in Pete Hegseth's leadership of the Pentagon.
I think there are a number of things that have raised concern that Congress is struggling with. And I think the secretary is going to have to answer those questions and address them. And I think the president is going to be struggling with that over the next month.
Today, select lawmakers began receiving classified briefings on the military strikes on alleged drug boats, looking into any war crimes potentially committed. And today, a Pentagon auditor released a report on Hegseth's use of the Signal app to share sensitive information about a pending strike on Houthis. The report found that this risked putting U.S. troops in danger. And let's start there as we welcome Paul McCleary, national security reporter for Politico. Paul, hello.
Hello.
This report came from the Pentagon Inspector General. Tell us more about its findings on the Signal chat possibly endangering U.S. forces.
Yeah, one of the big takeaways here from the report is that while Hegseth, he broke Pentagon rules by using a personal device and using a commercial app to convey classified information. He's able to declassify information as Secretary of Defense. So what happened is he got an email from the head of CENTCOM, General Kurilla, with the times of strikes in Yemen, the weapons being used, and the platforms used to send those weapons, all classified information. It was a classified email. He took that information, put it in the Signal chat, presumably declassified it in the process, and then sent it to Marco Rubio, J.D. Vance, and Mike Waltz, and other people in government on the chat. So while it was classified information, he has the power to declassify, although it's a little – we're still trying to figure out exactly how and when he declassified this information, how he made that decision.
Yep, I understand. The findings from the IG, you know, said that this Signal chat, which, you know, was out several hours before the actual strikes, could have endangered U.S. forces. For his part, Hegseth posted last night, quote, no classified information, total exoneration. What has the reaction been to this report from members of Congress and others?
There is some members of Congress, particularly Republican members, are kind of trying to skate by this a bit. No one's on the Republican side, at least, is directly criticizing Hegseth, although it must be said Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Roger Wicker, both Republicans, were both asked within the past 24 hours if they support Hegseth and both declined to answer.
All right.
Normally you'd see, of course we support the Secretary of Defense, things like that. Their silence, you know, while there's still they're not calling for his resignation, but their silence says a lot about where many Republicans on the Hill are with Pete Hegseth.
And we should note that Catherine Marr, the CEO of NPR, chairs the board of the Signal Foundation, whose subsidiary makes the Signal app. Today, a top commander, as you know, is debriefing Congress in a closed session on these boat strikes, notably the second strike the commander ordered, according to the White House, and this killed two survivors. It is reported the commander thought the strike was appropriate. The military law often forbids targeting civilians who do not pose an imminent threat. What more do we know about Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley's rationale here?
Yeah, I mean, early on in the Trump administration, the president and Hegseth gave commanders on the ground much more leeway to conduct these types of strikes. We've seen it in the Middle East. We've seen it in Iran, things like that. These are directed by commanders as opposed to the White House, which under the Biden administration, they took more of a hands-on approach to this. The rules are you're not to strike people who are wounded, enemy combatants who are out of the fight, things like that. And so the Pentagon's playing some, they're massaging the language here a little bit, right? They're saying since these men climbed back aboard the boat, they were still in the fight. Granted, they're unarmed. There is no fight. They're not combatants, but they're saying they're still in the fight and they're radioing for another boat to come. The boat could rescue them and continue carrying the drugs onward to wherever they were going. So they're saying that they weren't wounded and weren't out of the fight.
I understand. And Paul, just a question on Congress here. Today, Democratic Congressman Jim Hines of Connecticut told reporters he and fellow lawmakers watched unedited video of the follow-up strike, and he called it one of the most troubling things he's seen in his time in public service. As far as lawmakers, as far as Congress, how big a crisis could this become for the Pentagon, for the administration?
It has the potential to become a little more serious for the Pentagon here, right? Obviously we have not seen the video yet, but Himes and other members of Congress are really pushing for this to be released. We'll see what that video shows, but this isn't going to go away. I mean, this is really, it's not just about this strike. This is about the larger body of strikes. I think 21 over the past several months have killed over 80 people in the Caribbean. And I think members of Congress, mostly Democrats, but some key Republicans, right, too, mm-hmm, are very uneasy about what the Trump administration is doing here.
All right.
Trump came in as the peace president, and this isn't getting after that. Thank you.
Paul McCleary of Politico. Paul, thank you.
Sure thing. Thanks.
Well, meanwhile, President Trump continues his attacks on Somali migrants. Here he is yesterday denigrating the community of nearly 80,000 people living in Minnesota.
That beautiful land, that beautiful state, it's a hellhole right now. And the Somalians should be out of here. They've destroyed our country. And all they do is complain, complain, complain.
So those remarks come one day after Trump called Somali immigrants garbage. His anger toward the community has intensified just as the administration announced that ICE will be ramping up operations in Minneapolis and that longstanding protections for some Somali migrants will be coming to an end. Khaled Omar is with the statewide community organizing group Isaiah. He's on the line now. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
You're Somali American. When you hear the President of the United States talk like that, what do you hear? What do your friends and neighbors hear?
My friends and myself and my neighbors hear hateful rhetoric coming, from our president. And this hateful rhetoric are really dangerous. And many of my community right now are extremely fearful. This is not new to us. During 2016, Trump was campaigning in Minnesota. It was probably his last stop for his 2016 campaign. During that time, Trump attacked the Somali American community here in Minnesota. Right after 2016, in 2017, we had a white supremacist group that drove up to Minnesota and bombed a local mosque called the Darul Faruq Center. So the words that are coming from our president are really dangerous and have real consequences.
Well, right now, President Trump has also said he plans to end temporary protected status for Somalis living in the United States since the 1990s, because there's been an ongoing war there. Are people, you know, thinking about the prospect of being forced to return?
Peter, the number of people who are on the temporary status are less than 1,000 people. Many of the Somali Americans here in our country are citizens. And, you know, we believe that this is a sort of a distraction to what the real issue is. Many of our communities, the Minnesota community and also our country, are struggling. They're struggling with their, you know, basic necessities, their living expenses. Groceries are increasing highly. Instead of that, our president, you know, chose to attack a small, minute community. And the temporary protection status was a way to welcome refugees and immigrants to this country who are fleeing war, who are fleeing economic difficulties. So to, you know, to see that being weaponized is, you know, really unacceptable.
Well, I take your point that a lot of the Somali Americans in your area are U.S. citizens. So what do you make of the administration's decision to send immigration officials into the community?
Yesterday, we had ICE officers and federal officers who came to our, who are in our communities, in our mosques, and near our places of worship. And we have heard of people who are citizens who were being asked and questioned about their status here in this country. And that is just crazy to see law enforcement and ICE agents who are coming and who are, you know, literally harassing our communities. People right now are talking about, you know, should they be carrying their passport with them at all times so that they can make sure that they're not picked on or they're not detained. So this is what even my, you know, yesterday my mother was giving me a call and just telling me, hey, make sure you have your passport on. I never thought that would be the conversation that we would be having as a citizen in this country. This is something that it is really mind-boggling to be hearing from our community. But we've been telling our community to stay strong in this moment.
Well, as you know, the barrage of insults from the president started most recently because of a fraud scandal in Minnesota where dozens of people have been charged and convicted with felonies by prosecutors who say they stole more than $1 billion in federal and state money for social services during the pandemic. President Trump has used this as a justification for his attacks because, as you know, some of the people involved were from Somalia. Are you concerned about those convictions painting the community in a bad light?
Anyone who commits a who commits fraud or other crimes should be held accountable, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their race, religion. They should be held accountable. You know, I believe in the rule of law, and Somali Americans believe in the rule of law. And in America, we don't believe, or you know, in there's no such a thing as collective punishment. And to see our president scapegoat a whole community based off a few individuals, less than 1%, is unacceptable, and it is racist. It is very hateful to be seeing that from and hearing it from our president.
Khaled Omar in Minneapolis with the statewide community organizing group Isaiah. Khaled, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to Hear It Now.
We hear the word ideology a lot these days. Both conservatives and liberals use the term, but people tend only to refer to something as an ideology if they disagree with it.
Ideology has essentially become a form of name-calling. It's a way of sort of saying you have ridiculous or stupid beliefs.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the meaning of ideology has changed on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Early edition coming your way this afternoon, 1 o'clock.
Richmond R&B, Oakland hip-hop, San Francisco punk. Bay Area artists really delivered this year when it comes to music. I'm Nastia Vainovskaya, editor and reporter at KQED Arts and Culture. We rounded up 20 of the best Bay Area albums of 2025, and you can read all about them at kqed.org/arts.
Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus's Holiday Spectacular, a concert series across the Bay Area blending festive classics with campy showstoppers from Elton, Gaga, and more. Tickets at sfgmc.org. KQED's Bay Curious podcast, sponsored by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, featuring trivia questions at the end of each episode. Listen, test your Bay Area knowledge, and enter to win prizes at kqed.org/baycurious.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, defending church-state separation and the First Amendment, including freedom of the press, for nearly 80 years. Learn more at au.org.
It's Here and Now. Federal Immigration and Border Patrol agents are now focusing on Minneapolis in their deportation efforts. They also began work this week in New Orleans. One question is, months into this effort, where do local police forces fit? What do officers do and not do when federal agents come to town? Chuck Wexler is executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, an organization of law enforcement officials and others focused on professionalism in policing. And he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well. You have said immigration is a main issue that keeps police chiefs up at night, that they feel, quote, caught in the middle of all this. What do you mean?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the trust of the community is vital to them. At the same time, they share the objective of identifying people who commit violent crimes and getting them off the street. So it's a balancing act between working with the community, maintaining trust, and also working with the federal government in ways that make sense, and that is focusing on violent crime. But very often today, police departments are up against past patterns and laws and statutes that really stipulate how they can work with federal agencies. I think that the difficult aspect is the 11 million people who have been in this country for some time and are working. When ICE goes after that part of the population, that creates a lot of challenges.
And you mentioned building trust with local communities, a priority of your organization. But in some cases, say in Chicago, are these federal crackdowns eroding trust between neighborhoods and law enforcement?
Well, that's a good question, because for Chicago or for Los Angeles or Boston or any of these cities, police have worked for years to build public trust. It hasn't always been easy. And the relationship between ICE and local police can sometimes be uneven. ICE does not always notify police when they are doing an operation. And it doesn't help, honestly, when the ICE agents are masked and it's created concern as to whether or not they identify themselves. And that's become a sticking point in a lot of jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if I can ask a little bit more about that, as you know, these federal agencies say that their agents in cities have been doxxed when their faces have been in the open, been attacked on social media, etc. On the other hand, the New Orleans police superintendent recently asked ICE agents and Customs and Border Protection officers to remove face covering. So why is this question important from the standpoint of police officers and local communities?
It's interesting. It's a good question, because the FBI in November of this year sent out a bulletin alerting police departments that there were criminals who were now wearing masks. And so in Los Angeles or in Minneapolis, you have individuals who are committing crimes with masks. In fact, in Minnesota this past summer, you had that individual who shot senators, and he was masked, and he was, you know, purporting to be a law enforcement officer. Last night, I understand, in Minneapolis, you had criminals wearing masks. So people are calling up the police. They're questioning who it is. And, you know, police have been operating for the last 10 years. Everything that they have done in terms of whether it's name identifications, body-worn cameras, all of that is really where they have been going. So the whole mask issue, just I think it's unsettling for everyone.
You mentioned it a couple times that police officers feel caught in the middle. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Is there a practical example from these cities we've talked about that kind of goes to police being caught in the middle?
Well, I think the example this summer in Minneapolis, where the police were called to a scene where federal agents were conducting some kind of an arrest, and you know, you had a large crowd gathering, and the police were called because there was concern about disruption, and the community felt that it was an ICE operation. Well, it turns out it wasn't exactly an ICE operation, but nevertheless, there was a concern that the police were somehow cooperating with ICE, and so the police chief there had to clarify it. So I think this has happened in Los Angeles and Chicago and other cities, where ICE will conduct an operation, and then the community will be upset, and a large crowd will gather, and then the police will have to respond and try to do everything they can to deal with crowd controls. Well, the community can interpret that as the police working with ICE. So that's the challenge, you know, having to both maintain community trust and also understand that sometimes these federal agents will be endangered, and they have a responsibility to protect them as well.
For people in these local communities, why is it important for them to know the difference, to differentiate between a local police officer and a federal agent?
That's a really good question, because in all of these communities, the police have come to recognize that they have to police everyone in that community. And the reporting of crime, the cooperation with the police, all of those things depend upon maintaining trust with the community. If the community starts to mistrust the police, they won't report crime, they won't cooperate, they won't serve as witnesses. That really is, you know, very much established. Going back to Los Angeles in 1979, this is the pattern of many police departments, many communities, is maintaining community trust with all of the people in their community, whether they're here legally or not.
Chuck Wexler is Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum. Chuck, thanks for the time.
Thank you very much.
A massive data center is going up outside of Reno, Nevada. Massive meaning that when it's finished, the footprint of the campus will be larger than the city next door. All that computer hardware is expected to consume a lot of water, and Nevada is the driest state in the country. Caleb Radel with the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
Brian Armin, a commercial real estate broker, drives to the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center.
Directions to 2555 USA Parkway.
Keenan Eagle Inc. The center rises from the sagebrush like a pop-up book.
The building that you see up on the hill there, that's Vantage Data Center's Edge Core. That's a data center that's under construction.
Here, outside of Reno, Armin says tech giants are racing to turn desert land into the backbone of the internet and AI. It checks all the boxes for data centers. Plenty of land, few climate-related disasters like hurricanes and flash floods, and big tax breaks.
We've had a massive amount of data centers that have shown up, and more that are looking.
By 2027, AI is expected to account for 28% of the global data center market, according to Goldman Sachs. That's more than double its current share. This data center boom is not just happening in northern Nevada. Across the West, including Colorado, Wyoming, and Arizona, states have rolled out major tax incentives to attract data centers. But rising concern over their water use is fueling public pushback. In Tucson, Arizona, for example, outcry over a data center project led officials to pull support.
Data centers generate a lot of heat, and the easiest, most efficient way of cooling them down is water.
That's Stanford hydrologist Nusha Ajami, who says these centers are like thirsty crops, but permanent.
You have to continuously water them, right? So it doesn't provide that flexibility that's needed, especially during dry or drought periods.
A 2024 federal report found that U.S. data centers consume 17 billion gallons of water a year. But that's a drop in the bucket compared to industries like mining or farming, which use billions of gallons every day. But demand from data centers is expected to double or even quadruple soon, according to that report. And Ajami says in the arid West, where water is finite,
people are concerned about their water and who's using it and how.
This comes as climate change is shrinking Western snowpacks, says Sean McKenna. He leads hydrologic sciences at the nonprofit Desert Research Institute.
And that's not good because snow is like our water tower, right? That's how we store that moisture for later in the year.
Today, about 75% of the West is in drought. In Nevada, more than half its groundwater basins are overallocated. More water exists on paper than underground. Still, the water district for the data center hub outside of Reno isn't alarmed yet. It holds rights to more than 4 billion gallons a year. Sherry Whalen, the district's general manager, says it has the water to handle the center's growth.
Our plan is not to bring water in from anywhere else. Our plan is to fully and responsibly utilize the resources we have.
Put another way, she says,
what we're trying to do is make sure that nothing basically goes vertical without a water resource tied to it.
Several data center developers outside of Reno say they plan to use more efficient cooling systems to reduce water use. That mirrors a broader shift happening nationwide. Dean Ball, an AI policy expert, says data centers are trying to shrink their water footprint.
These days, the trend in AI data center design is really to go to closed loop water systems.
That means the water is reused over and over. Still, in the driest parts of the country, available water remains a concern and is tightly controlled by regulators. Right now, Nevada has about 60 data centers, with at least a dozen more planned in the coming years. For NPR News, I'm Caleb Bradle in Reno.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll remember Steve Cropper, the guitarist, songwriter, and producer who was behind the rise of R&B powerhouse Stax Records. He died yesterday in Nashville at 84. You can hear that story on the NPR app or your local member station. It's Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Sharon Brody. A federal vaccine advisory committee decided today to delay a vote on whether all babies should still get the hepatitis B vaccine within 24 hours of birth. For decades, the government has advised that all infants be vaccinated against the liver infection right after they're born. The shots are widely considered to be a public health success for preventing thousands of illnesses. But the committee, formed by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an outspoken critic of vaccines, is considering whether to recommend the birth dose only for babies whose mothers test positive for Hep B. The Pentagon's top independent watchdog has released its findings on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's use of an unsecure group chat app to communicate sensitive operational details. The report concludes that Hegseth violated Pentagon policies. The report says Hegseth's actions could have risked harm to personnel and mission objectives. No hostile adversaries did intercept and act on the information. Hegseth says that exonerates him. A Virginia man has been charged with an explosives offense after being arrested by the FBI on suspicion of placing pipe bombs in Washington before the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The Attorney General identified the suspect as Brian Cole Jr. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED today comes from Bart's, helping to make holiday travel easier with just one quick tap of any bank card. Riders can be on their way to SFO or OAK to start their holiday adventures. More ways to pay at bart.gov/tapandride. Landmark College commemorating 40 years of educating people who learn differently, with programs on campus and online for both students and professionals. Learn more at landmark.edu. Sacramento Valley, some cloud cover, still some morning fog, some clearing today, high 55 for the capital city. Patchy fog returns after midnight, lows in the valley 37 to 43. Around the bay today, partly sunny. The rest of this Thursday, highs in the lower 50s to the mid-60s. King tides, coastal flood advisory, that's in effect through Sunday afternoon officially.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, Storyworth will publish their stories in color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at storyworth.com. And MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
It's Here and Now. In San Antonio, a group of Latina grandmothers in their 70s and 80s have formed a dance troupe known as Las Abuelitas de Oro. The name is inspired by the popular sitcom The Golden Girls. These grandmothers have reignited their love for regional Mexican dances, and Texas Public Radio's Ivana Boss Caldera has the story.
On a bright Sunday morning at a city park in Texas, Las Abuelitas de Oro elegantly grab their long, colorful dresses and sway them as they dance to a set of traditional Mexican songs in front of a few dozen people. Dolores de León Savage is 85 years old. She's been dancing since she was 3. For decades, she owned dance studios. Now, as a retired dance teacher, she helps older Latinas stay in touch with their Hispanic culture.
When we perform, we just go out there and, like, we're teenagers, even though we're in our 80s. Because, you know, yeah, we do have pains and aches and everything, but, you know, when we're dancing, everything is gone.
Las Abuelitas became a formal folklorico group just a year ago, and they offer free performances year-round throughout San Antonio. 73-year-old Michelle McDonald was born in Cuba and raised in Texas. Her journey with dancing began at 7 when she learned ballet, jazz, and flamenco. She stopped dancing after her career as a dental hygienist, marriage, and raising a son took priority. After retirement, she took on folklorico.
I always like it when they call out the age. They say, we've got a group here from 73 to 86. And you can hear the gasps in the audience. I love that.
Sandra Rodriguez stopped dancing after high school. She worked in banking, married, and raised 2 children. Now at 73, she says folklorico brings her joy and helps her stay healthy.
It helps with our coordination, with our balance, with our memory, you know, because we have to remember our steps, what's next. So it's all very good for our health.
The group practices at least 3 hours every week. Part of their mission is to pass down their culture to newer generations by teaching folklorico to an elementary dance group known as Los Rayitos de Sol, or Little Sunbeams. These students and the abuelitas perform at the San Antonio Park to the songs Guadalajara and Jesucita en Chihuahua, while the sun highlights the dancers' vibrant Jalisco ribbon dresses. Rodriguez, who goes by Sandy, says being a part of the group has helped these women find a purpose post-retirement.
Working with the children has been just fantastic. They're beautiful, and they're so eager to learn, you know, and the dancing, they love to dance, and then, you know, we're showing them our culture.
Las Abuelitas are refreshing their dancing set and rehearsing to perform during Las Posadas, a Catholic tradition in Latin America commemorating Mary and Joseph's journey to Bethlehem before the birth of Jesus. For NPR News, I'm Ivana Vaz Caldera in San Antonio.
This is Here and Now.
Prices for everything from cars to coffee are soaring, but you can count on some things getting cheaper because they have been for decades. Computers. Storing and processing information has gotten more efficient and more cost-effective over time.
The number of transistors incorporated in a chip will approximately double every 24 months.
But will that last? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning, stay informed. Start your day early, 2 o'clock until 9 for NPR's morning edition on KQED News tomorrow morning. This week on Spooked, Ray hated being a paperboy for the hard route and rude customers, But there was one customer who was different from the rest, and Ray didn't understand why. That's on Spooked, wherever you get your podcasts. Support for KQED comes from Rising Team, creator of Supermanager AI, giving leaders at all levels a leadership personal trainer and coaching partner to help build essential skills, practice hard conversations, and strengthen team performance. Learn more at supermanager.ai. And by visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Visitorscoverage.com. The announcers, technical staff of KQED are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station. And from Olin College of Engineering, they believe in the power of interdisciplinary learning and experimentation to make engineering education more practical, impactful, and fun. Learn more at olin.edu. And the Museum of Science Boston, where visitors can experience live presentations with indoor lightning storms, animals, robotics, and hands-on design challenges. Learn more at mos.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. White House officials have shuttled between Russia and Ukraine back to Russia seeking peace without a breakthrough. Let's take a long view now of this war and where it may go with Russia scholar Fiona Hill. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and worked on Russia issues in the first Trump White House. She later testified at Trump's first impeachment hearing. Fiona Hill, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be with you.
You know, American envoys recently went to Russia to craft a peace plan for Ukraine. Then they went to Ukraine, modified the plan, then shuttled back to Russia. No obvious route to peace. Any signs that this war will end soon?
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, I wish I could say that that would be the case. It would take, you know, some kind of major breakthrough, which, you know, it's always a possibility. There's always those outside chances that nobody should rule anything out. But there's just no sign that Vladimir Putin at this particular juncture wants to give up anything short of pretty serious demands that it's very hard to imagine Ukraine accepting, notwithstanding the fact that, of course, Ukraine is hurting from this war. Of course it is. And this war has been a colossal cost to Russia, too. And President Trump, you know, to give him credit for this, is trying to create some momentum here. But the timeline is his. It's Trump's. It's not necessarily the course of the war. There's no catastrophic defeat that is facing Ukraine right now, although there are pretty considerable setbacks. And again, there's nothing to indicate that the pressure has got significantly high for Vladimir Putin, that he'd be contemplating, you know, pushing for a peace deal at this point.
Well, here's a piece of sound from Secretary of State Marco Rubio. He spoke this week to Fox News.
Some of these people have this notion that our policy should be just continue to fund Ukraine in unlimited amounts for as long as the war takes. That's not realistic. That's not reality.
That's not reality, according to Rubio. If the U.S. really pulls back significantly on support for Ukraine, what would that mean?
Well, it'd be very difficult. And it would mean that the Europeans really will have to pull out all the stops to step up. I mean, there is action being taken, but the question is whether it's going to be, you know, fast enough to do that. After, you know, the rather disastrous meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office, there was a pullback of intelligence sharing and as well as a stoppage of weapons supplies to Ukraine. And it hurt. But I think there's also an overestimation of the importance of U.S. intelligence sharing and to some degree some of the other assistance that the U.S. has been providing from Patriots, you know, to other, you know, missile systems, and the fact that these are the silver bullets or, you know, the most effective ways of having Ukraine, you know, hold its own on the battlefield. I think the real secret for Ukraine now is to work, you know, very closely with European allies. Secretary Rubio is just making that really clear that they better move fast on this and to, you know, basically devise its own systems. It's already been doing that, to be frank. But this is significant, obviously.
You have also talked, Fiona Hill, recently about Ukraine, its military's innovation, the Ukrainians' resolve in this war. What should Americans know about that? We have not talked too much about military innovation in Ukraine, at least in the U.S.
No, we haven't. And we haven't also accepted the fact that, you know, Ukraine's actually right now got the largest and most capable military in Europe. But Ukraine was also something of a significant military power before the invasion. It was one of the reasons that Russia wanted to seize control of Ukraine. Ukraine, remember, 30 plus years ago when it's part of the former Soviet Union, was one of the military arsenals, one of the major manufacturing sites for the Soviet military. And what you see now is Ukrainians really picking up the pace of innovation on the battlefield of drones. I mean, yes, the Russians are learning from that as well and doing the same, but they're doing it from the top down. Ukraine is really significant on the grassroots level, on the battlefield. The Ukrainians have managed to take out a third of the Russia's Black Sea fleet using, you know, autonomous weapon systems, you know, adapting the equivalent of drones, you know, in the air for the sea as well. And the Ukrainians will say themselves that Patriots, the kind of, you know, weapon systems that they were asking for before from the United States, are no longer as relevant on the battlefield, or tanks. Wow. You know, some of these debates that we had before, that's no longer the way that the battlefield is playing out.
On the Russia side, Russia is losing about 7,000 soldiers a week. That's according to Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State. How can Putin keep sending so many people to the front lines, people willing to go?
Well, there's two elements to that. First of all, it's not just people who are killed, it's also grievously wounded. So, you know, some people do get put back into action again. But Russia's doing something quite remarkable. It's actually using an almost entirely mercenary force in the sense that most of these are contract soldiers. So it's paying for people to go, which is why people continue to go.
Paying a lot of money? Is this a lot of money to them?
They are. It is a lot of money. In the Russian context, it's a lot of money. And no, modern military obviously goes in with, you know, forcible conscription to major wars. But no modern military is really kind of paying people what would be, you know, a pretty enviable wage if you're in the normal labor force. And the Russians are calculating, and Putin and the people around him are calculating, that they can do this for another couple of years.
Is there a possibility, Fiona Hill, that you and I are speaking on December 4th, 2 years from now, about this war still going on?
It's entirely possible, as I said, absent some major change. Putin, I would think, has still got the upper hand in terms of not just the battlefield, although they're only making very incremental gains for these horrific losses, but he's got the upper hand right now in the propaganda and information battlefield. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the election of Trump was a great benefit for Putin because, you know, President Trump, you know, doesn't want to continue this war in Ukraine. He would like to wipe his hands of it. So, you know, so that is a major change that plays to Putin's benefit, of course. But remember, for Ukraine, this is existential. They're fighting for their right to exist as Ukrainians.
And briefly, I want to take us back to a conversation you and I had back in February of 2022 at the WBUR space in Boston. But Russia at the time was deploying troops in eastern Ukraine. It was not yet clear what was going to happen, and you and I spoke then. Let's take a listen.
What is the argument that, yes, this is an invasion? What's the argument that, no, it's actually not?
Well, it's very hard to say that it's not, because, in fact, this is the third time around that Russia has invaded Ukraine.
So you were suggesting then, yes, this was a Russian invasion happening, February of 2022. Has anything since then about this long and bloody war surprised you, gone differently than you'd imagined?
Well, it's certainly gone different from Putin imagined, you know, yeah. And I think at that particular point, I mean, perhaps we couldn't have imagined that, you know, the Ukrainians would be able to, you know, hold the Russians back to the extent that they have, admittedly, of course, with support from neighbors and also from the United States. Putin thought this was a special military operation. Yes, it was an invasion, but he thought it was going to be like 1956 when the Red Army went into Hungary, or 1968 when they went into Czechoslovakia, you know, for example. And that is actually the surprising element of this war that should be, everybody should be taking on board, that Russia, the much vaunted military power, has effectively been, you know, held to account by the Ukrainians. Even if they haven't been able to totally turn the tide and push the Russians back, they've been incredibly enduring. They've showed a lot of fortitude. They showed a lot of bravery. They showed a lot of persistence here.
And one quick question, Fiona Hill. In this hemisphere, the U.S. strikes on assumed drug boats coming from Venezuela, threats to Venezuela, and the argument from this administration that this is about U.S. national security. What do you make of that?
Well, linking it to what we've just been talking about, the Russians, you know, see this as basically the United States and President Trump doing exactly, you know, what they're doing in their neighborhood. Ukraine's an issue of national security. It's their realm to do as they will and to address threats. And so, you know, what we're seeing as a result of this decision on the part of the Trump administration is that this actually paves the way for many other countries, not just Russia, you know, to launch similar kinds of actions in their neighborhoods and to describe things in, you know, in any way they want to.
Kind of giving permission,
giving permission
for Russia to justify what it's doing, perhaps give China permission if it decides to do something with Taiwan.
Yeah, and you'll also see as a result of what's happened there and that recognition by some of the US closest allies, including the UK, that they're now, you know, very reluctant to share intelligence with the United States in, you know, the general region. You've got to remember that, you know, there are British Virgin Islands there, you know, the Dutch, you know, a whole host of other European countries have equities in the, you know, the broader Caribbean region. So there's a lot of consternation and concern about this in Europe as well.
Fiona Hill is Russia scholar and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She worked in the White House in the first Trump administration, also served under Presidents Obama and George W. Bush. Fiona Hill, thank you so much. Nice to talk to you once again.
Thanks, Scott. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now. The Trump administration has raised the idea of a 50-year mortgage. Could mean lower monthly payments, but the interest would really add up. Next time, Here and Now.
We'll learn more about the 50-year mortgage and more topics coming up. The second hour of Here and Now starts at the top of the hour. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and Onstage Blizzard runs December 5th to 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. Xfinity delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And City Space Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or enhance customer connections. WBUR.org/creative studio.
It's Here and Now. With a periodic segment, I'm going to start calling Games with James. The video game and board game expert on our staff, James Mastromarino, is here to talk about NPR's 2025 list called Games We Love. It features favorites nominated by NPR staff members and contributors across the network. Here is a sampling of what those games sound like.
May the wind of renewal take you to the ends of the earth.
Death to Kronos.
Death to Kronos.
James edited this list. Hey, James, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well.
Let's start with board games, because you watch those two, report on those two. Give me one that you loved from this year.
Well, I think the breakout of the season is a game called The Old King's Crown. It's this sumptuously illustrated strategy card game that plays over 4 to 6 rounds. So once you get going, it can feel very quick and snappy, but it has these beautiful, like, tarot-sized cards, you know, big ones that you play out. And essentially, it's a game of war. You know, the old card game where you just flip over cards and the highest value wins. It's that, except each of the value cards also has different effects, and you play them secretly face down simultaneously to all of these three battlefields.
Oh,
then
fun.
You flip them up and crazy shenanigans happen. It is pretty brilliant, especially considering that it was illustrated and designed by one person.
Oh my goodness.
And it comes in a very big box, but don't let that intimidate you. If you're somebody who loves, like, really deep strategic gameplay, it's perfect.
One person, that seems to be a theme this year, is small companies, indies on the video game front. You have said this was kind of a year for the indies. What do you mean?
Yeah, I feel like I've been saying this every year, but it's never been more true in 2025. Like, we saw some real breakouts from new studios like Clair Obscur Expedition 33, which is this masterpiece cinematic French game that plays a little bit like a French New Wave movie, crossed with like an existentialist novel, crossed with sort of like a surreal adventure. It's heartfelt and extremely moving. The most French game I have ever played. It's got baguettes and everything. And then you also have returning hits like Hades 2, which is about battling your way either to the bottom of the Greek underworld or to the very tops of Olympus to defeat the Titan of Time, Kronos himself.
I understand a lot of the games the NPR staff and contributors like are these kind of playable movies or playable TV shows. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I mentioned Clair Obscur, which is very cinematic. There's even like black and white cutscenes, but games have been getting so high budget that you get things like Death Stranding 2, an exclusive for Sony's PlayStation 5, starring Norman Reedus, Lea Seydoux, Elle Fanning. While the game of it is basically like you're a science fiction UPS guy wandering around like the outback of Australia in this post-apocalypse, it's really sold by these visuals and by these performances. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you get something like Dispatch, which is a superhero comedy, but it looks like one of those kind of animated shows for grown-ups, kind of like Invincible or The Legend of Vox Machina on Prime TV. You make decisions, it impacts this big story about a bunch of misfit superheroes, and it also stars some great voice talent like Jeffrey Wright and Aaron Paul.
Let me pause you here. Anything on this list, the NPR Games We Love list, surprise you?
Yeah, so our staff has a predilection for two things that seem diametrically opposed. The first is cozy games, things like Tiny Bookshop, where you just wander around selling books to people. There's no violence. There's rarely any threats. And then also horror. Lots of small horror games. Eclipsium, Look Outside.
So these games, extremes.
Exactly. And the thing is, they can sometimes meet in the middle in something like Strange Antiquities, which is about selling dangerous artifacts to Victorian townspeople. Huh. And I would call it a cozy game. It certainly was for me. But it's pretty creepy. There's a lot of like hijinks and occultism in it.
Wow. Well, let's talk about at least one big giant company in the space, Nintendo, right? The company came out with this new console called the Switch 2 after running into challenges, right? Supply chain issues from the pandemic. It ran into tariffs coming into the United States from the Trump administration. In the eyes of this NPR survey, is the price tag, are the games worth it?
Yeah, Nintendo did anger some fans by pricing games at sometimes $80, but they really did innovate with Mario Kart World this year. Mario Kart's been around since the 90s, but they really changed up the format. It's this huge interconnected space that you can drive around basically anywhere, depending on how the courses direct you. And then they also came out with another racing game, Kirby Air Riders, which I adore. And then finally, Donkey Kong Bonanza, which casts the ape that we all know as this kind of unstoppable, destructive force that's literally tunneling his way to the center of the earth.
Well, thank you for talking to My Vintage, mentioning Donkey Kong, mentioning Mario Kart. That is our own James Mastromarino on NPR's Games of the Year. James, thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com.
Hi, it's Layla Faldin from NPR. Earlier this year, I reported a special series for Morning Edition about free speech in the U.S., and I'll never forget what one leading scholar of the First Amendment told me. He said, "Free speech is the right from which all other rights flow. If we lose it, we lose the power to stand up for any of our other freedoms." Please stand up for free speech and a free press by giving to this station today.
Give at kqed.org/donate.
Heading over to our traffic desk on KQED with Julie Depish. What's going on?
Dave, we are looking at a crash on the upper deck of the Bay Bridge, the center anchorage. You've got two vehicles blocking the left lane, really backing up now into the tunnel. Oakland wreck on southbound 880. It's the on-ramp from Heckenberger Road. Two vehicles there are actually blocking the on-ramp. And dealing with the King Tides again today, Mill Valley, northbound 101. The off-ramp to Highway 1, Stinson Beach, shut down until 3:30 this afternoon. Julie Depish for KQED.
Thank you. Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better